If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
You might remember yesterday we had on Marianne Mead Ward, the mayor of Burlington, and talking about strong mayor's powers. And I thought this was fascinating because I remember the mayor saying on this show that she disagreed with all of that and would not be using the strong mayor's powers, and then admitted on the show that, in fact, yes, she had done that. Went on to say also that she didn't ask for them. As if, I don't know, someone making them use it, making her use them. I'm not sure, because it would seem like that would be a choice. So let's hear from the council side of this. Burlington Ward 3 councillor Rory Nissan weighs in, and this is a note that came after the council meeting. A city council unanimously voted to request that the mayor delegate the strong mayor's powers that can be delegated according to the Ontario Municipal Act. These include the hiring and firing of the city manager being delegated to council, where the power was before the imposition of a strong mayor's power. Similarly, the power to hire and fire management staff at the city is requested to be delegated to the city manager. I brought this motion forward along with other councillors because the strong mayor's powers are clearly anti-democratic and the cause of dysfunction at the city. The mayor has said that she does not need the power, so I'm hopefully they will delegate expeditiously in order to restore council to its highest functioning status and provide a stable atmosphere at the city. And then goes on from there. To talk more, Burlington Ward 3 City Councillor Rory Nissan with us. Rory, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I'm doing great. Thanks, Scott.
So how has this or the strong mayor's powers led to dysfunction at City Hall?
Yeah, you know what? It's not necessarily the use of the powers, although the powers have been used for various functions, some discretionary, some mandatory as per the Municipal Act. But it's the fact that if the powers exist and can be used, that it creates this like this weird environment where staff, you know, may end up being worried about how they're perceived out of the mayor's office.
So is this the threat that you're going to be overrode in some way?
Yeah, I mean, there's very clear provisions for the mayor passing bylaws and passing the budget with only a third support. And it's also clear that the city manager, for example, can be hired and fired by the mayor exclusively. So council cannot hire and fire the city manager anymore. And, you know, that's an important part of democratic oversight. I mean, you're talking about the CAO of the municipality.
Has the mayor, in your opinion, used these powers in a way that she shouldn't have or that has led to dysfunction?
You know, overall, if you look at the decisions, the mayor has not overreached in a significant way. We did see just a small element where committee chairs were chosen by the mayor, and I believe that the consultation was insufficient before she made that decision. And it led to one council member chairing two committees in the same year, which is highly unusual. That was eventually rectified, I believe, through council amendments. So in Burlington, it has not been a scenario where the mayor has been overusing the powers. It's really the environment that's at risk and potential for dysfunction.
Potential for dysfunction and dysfunction are two totally different things, Councillor. What does this have to do with the high turnover rate at the city, or does it, whether it's city manager, what have you?
Yeah, you know, Scott, I'm bound by the Municipal Act not to get into individual HR matters, which sounds like a pretty political response, but that is a fact. I don't want to be, pulled before my integrity commissioner for revealing closed session items. So I can't go into details about individual HR matters. But what I can say is that we have seen in other municipalities where a mayor has hired a city manager without a lot of process or fired several senior cadre. And certainly nobody would want to see that happen. I'm really focused on the act and the strong mayor powers and how they create a climate of dysfunction. And frankly, they're anti-democratic.
I can understand all that, focusing on the act and anti-democratic, but I also can't see this being an item that people are talking around their Burlington supper tables. At the end of the day, either there's a problem here or there isn't a problem here. And it has been suggested in the media anyway, and certainly not denied by anybody, that this is somehow related to a high turnover and that the mayor is abusing strong mayor's powers. Would you say that's the situation?
Well, I would say that that I definitely I cannot get into those HR matters. But the turnover at City Hall overall, like we've seen it, but we haven't seen that it is much worse than other municipalities. So I think that people may be drawing a correlation there. And overall, no, I don't think turnover is at this point across the organization is related to the strong mayor powers. No, I really don't think so.
This sounds, Councillor, and I don't mean to be trivial here, but, you know, we're using words like dysfunctional and you know, we're bringing in situations of retention and such. And it really sounds like unless anyone wants to come clean here, this is a power struggle about nothing. Other than someone doesn't like the mayor having all the powers and making the decision. But, you know, at the end of the day, if it's working for the city, unless there's a problem, what's the problem?
Yeah, I think I appreciate the question, but I think there is a problem when a minority of elected officials can make decisions for the entire municipality. And that's what the strong mayor powers do.
Can you give us an example where that's used and it has been abused or it hasn't worked in the favor of the city? Like that all sounds great. However, can you give us an example where it hasn't worked, where this has gotten in the way and it has been a detriment to the city? Do we have an example of that?
You know, here in Burlington, the mayor has actually been pretty consensus driven around things like the budget. So I can't say that it has been an issue here, but I worry about the future. What if we have a Rob Ford type of a mayor in the future, and that person now only has a 1/3 majority? I'm trying to protect us going down the road, to be honest.
I would be worried about a Rob Ford mayor when the Rob Ford mayor shows up. I don't think that's what we're discussing around the Burlington kitchen table. This sounds like a power struggle over nothing. And unless more comes forward, I'm not seeing it as a problem. It's just that the mayor has taken advantage of powers that have been provided to her. And it's, in her opinion, to the advantage of the city. And until we have something that's that says otherwise, other than that person shouldn't have all the control. I mean, again, it's still, you know, again, I don't see what the problem is at this point.
Sure. I mean, I wasn't elected to city council to wait for problems to occur to fix them. I was elected to do the right thing when the opportunities were in front of me. And these delegation of powers are in front of the mayor, and she's been able to delegate them since they were brought down, only certain powers, but that's exactly what council has unanimously requested, that she delegate some of her powers so we can have more democratic oversight of the entire council of the organization.
Did Burlington meet its housing target with the province this year, this 2023, and how come not?
So you answered your own question there, Scott, but no, we did not meet our housing target. But the housing target as created is based on, you know, number of foundations poured. And as you know, I can't be trusted with a hammer, so I don't build houses myself. What we need to do is approve what's in front of us very quickly and expeditiously. And we have 40,000 units in the pipeline, whether they've applied, whether that pre-application, whether they've been approved, permitted. So the key is the process as far as the city is concerned. We need to move these applications, get them to a conclusion as quickly as possible. But I vehemently disagree with the province giving out funding on the basis of something that we don't control. Only developers can build houses, and we know with high interest.
All right, Rory. Rory, we got to go. The only thing Burlingtonites don't understand is how come other province or other cities are getting the money and they're not. But that's something you'll have to explain to them. Rory Nissen with us, Deputy Mayor, Regional, and City Burlington Councillor, and talking in regard to the strong mayor's powers. All right, this is I love talking about this and trying to strategize. Because, well, I've how old are they now? 17 and 22. Oh my God. Yeah, turning this year. Anyway, two kids and social media, they don't touch it. They're just not interested in it. No. You know what it's like. It's like every family. Well, Florida is now throwing around a social media ban, ages kids 14, under 14, and not being able to do this, 14 and 15, I think, without parental consent. It's an interesting way of looking at it. Will this work? I still think that this isn't as hard to control as everybody thinks it is. Because to me, the ultimate disciplinary tool is to say, give me the phone. And it's like you're taking the air out of their lungs. So, I mean, to me, it's the best invention ever as far as that. But, you know, some have problems with it. Dr. Sandra Bozaski with us, professor in the Faculty of Education, Brock University, director of Brock's Theory of Mind in Education, and here now. Sandra, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yes, thank you so much. I hope you're well as well. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Sandra, so let's start with, before we get to whether this is good or bad, let's start with that. Is this good or bad, or is this something we can't even do? As soon as you take something away, people want it more.
Yes, exactly, yes. And this is the key question about the, and that's why it's such a complex issue, actually, especially with adolescents, like teenagers. So there's benefits, and there's also limitations and consequences for, so there's positive and negative, and they pretty much balance each other out. So you could find a great deal of research to support the benefits of engagement on, you know, any kind of digital tools. And then there's also a great deal of research that suggests that there's a lot of harmful, social-emotional implications as well, depending on, again, the content as well as the context.
Mm.
So where are these youth? Like, where are they? Are they by themselves on their phone? Are they with their friends? Or are they with their family? And then what are they looking at?
It's almost like anything in life that we enjoy, too much of it is a bad thing, not enough of it, you don't experience life. So how do you find that balance? And is that up to the state or the parent?
Again, that's a great question. And I think, again, it's about asking questions and encouraging really kind of critical thinking within the family context, but also given that they're adolescents, within their peer context, within their with their friendships, encouraging to ask questions, to critically look at what they're engaged with, and then also within the schools. So again, the larger societal issue, I think everyone plays a part. It needs to be a collaborative effort on all parts.
Have we lost, or have younger people, students, I shouldn't say younger people because there's lots of older people that are the same way, have we lost critical thinking with social media? Have we lost the ability to do that, to think beyond step two?
Right. That's a great question, and I think it's possible for everybody. Children learn those skills very young to question and to be critical of what they're seeing and ask questions and be curious. And wonder, why is this? What are the reasons? So I think it's possible, and I think it could be encouraged and modeled by youth leaders, parents, teachers, adults, anyone who works with youth. They can learn through watching their adults engage with media in a critical way. They can they can play video games together. They could engage in social media. But again, it's asking those questions and thinking, encouraging them to reflect on how does this make me feel as well, because you need to think about the emotional impact of what they're engaged with.
Is always having the instant answer perhaps made us a little lazy when it comes to critical thinking, a little lazy to think, well, this is the right answer, it's in front of me, as opposed to questioning it and searching other sources?
Yes, that's a good point. And I think it is, part of it is the this less time it takes to look at and to solve a problem if they think that's solving the problem. So that could be one of the draws for engaging in particular types of digital media. Again, it depends. It's such a large area, and there's so many different areas. Like, there's social media, but there's also video games, there's digital technology, artificial intelligence, there's so many. So you need to think about why. What are their motivations for using these digital tools or communicative tools?
What tips do you have for parents who are perhaps dealing with this? And you brought up a point earlier, Sandra, and I thought it was quite interesting that, you know, and here's what I interpreted out of that. You know, if you're going to spend all your time when you got FaceTime with the kid and you're on your phone, what do you expect them to be doing? So what can we do as parents to kind of draw the line, find the balance?
Yes. No, that's a great point. And there's many ways. Again, if it comes within, think about the family environment and how you could create an open, critical, thinking community within the family, and you could encourage questioning. And instead of saying, oh, well, you can't look at this at all, like, you could watch something that they're interested in and question what interests you in this. Like, why are you motivated to perhaps play this video game, or why are you motivated to go on this social media site and to ask questions? So you could engage together, and you can also help them to make, especially adolescents, help them make choices that are more helpful instead of harmful for themselves, for example. So they can help their children make those choices by either acting as role models, but also encouraging them to use their own kind of thinking skills and responsibility and being accountable for their own decisions.
We have a simple rule, and it's pretty tough to enforce, but we've had it since they were young, so it's not an issue. And it's like no phones at the table. It's amazing how difficult it is to just keep that going.
Yeah. No, that's an excellent point. And yes, there's a great deal of research that suggests that just like any muscle, we need to keep working at something. So the ability to speak and verbalize with others, either face-to-face or over the phone. But again, it's a skill that you need to keep working at. And if it's only on only one mode of communication, such as digital, you need to keep the ability to have conversations, to engage with someone face to face. It's different. So I think that's important to have time that's sacred and that's away from any kind of digital space, because you need to be aware in person.
Dr. Sandra Basaki with us, professor in the Faculty of Education, Brock University, director of Brock's Theory of Mind in Education. Florida working on a ban to ban kids 14 and under from using social media. We'll see where that goes. Sandra, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Okay, thank you so much, Scott. Thank you for having me. All the best.
A senior Bank of Canada official says the need to improve productivity in Canada has reached an emergency level as the economy faces a future where inflation may be more of a threat than in the past few decades. Quote, you know those signs that say in an emergency break the glass? Well, it's time to break the glass, says Bank of Canada senior deputy governor Carolyn Rogers in a speech yesterday. To talk more about all of this, Colin Mang, assistant professor economics, McMaster University, and here now. Colin, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing well. Thanks, Scott. How are you today?
So far, so good. Colin, what are your thoughts on this statement? It's a pretty stern warning from the Bank of Canada.
The productivity issue in Canada has been an ongoing problem for many years. Our productivity has basically been flat since before the COVID period. And there's a number of reasons why productivity in Canada has lagged so much. But the thing is, when you compare Canada to other developed countries, especially to other G7 countries, we've seen their economies grow faster and their worker productivity rise. And this has led to better working conditions. It's led to them earning more money. In some places, it's led to them being able to work less hours and have a better quality of life. But in Canada, we've been lagging behind.
Why is that?
There's a number of reasons for it. So productivity comes from a number of places. First of all, the amount that we invest in machinery and equipment for workers. So in Canada, we do lag behind many other countries like France, Germany, on that measure. And also research and development spending. Canada lags way behind many other developed countries. In Canada, we spend about 1.5% of our national income on research and development. In comparison, you look at the United States, you look at Japan, you look at Germany, you look at the United Kingdom, they're all spending 3% or more than double the share of their income on research and development. So this is one of the things that's really held Canada back, is that we don't invest enough in both physical capital, equipment, and machinery to help our workers be more productive. And we also don't invest as much in innovation.
Is this a priority for us? Is this a priority for government? Are we open for business?
Well, I think it should be a priority for government. There's been a number of things at both the federal and provincial level over the last few years to try to make Canada a more productive place. So at the federal level, they have the Cluster Initiative, which is trying to diversify and also trying to encourage particularly high technology companies in different sectors across the country. Here in Ontario, we've got a provincial government that's doing some basic things like building new infrastructure, widening highways. That's the kind of things that, you know, make it easier to move goods around, to improve trade. We also have that new bridge that's being constructed in Windsor. Once that opens, that's going to make cross-border trade much easier. So, you know, those basic types of infrastructure things as well will help to give us a productivity boost in the future once they're fully built.
Is the Bank of Canada changing its tune? I had one expert say the other day that it seems like it's trying to separate itself from the government, where perhaps the economy and business isn't a top priority.
Yeah, so the Bank of Canada, it's been a little bit funny over the past couple of months because they were talking in December about potentially needing to raise rates again. And then they've been talking in January, February about holding things steady, hinting that a rate cut might be coming. But now they're coming out and saying, well, unless productivity improves, we're going to have this persistent inflation problem. So I think they're trying to manage people's expectations and trying to get people to understand that we're not going back to the era of 1%, 1.5% interest rates, that they're probably going to be landing at 3%, 3.5%, maybe 4%. But I do think they're just trying to be very careful in the way they manage people's expectations right now.
How does the federal government react to this? You know, obviously, in emergency, break the glass. Those are strong words. How does government react to that?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a number of things, and we're going to have to watch out for that federal budget. We had the provincial budget yesterday where they announced a whole bunch of new infrastructure spending, which should help with our productivity issue. We'll have to watch the federal budget's coming up in a few weeks' time if they're going to continue with some of the investments that they've made. Again, we need more investment in physical infrastructure. Some of the other stuff that we could be using. So the government has introduced... They've introduced the accelerated investment incentive. So this allows companies to write off the full value of some of the machinery and equipment that they're buying, which is another thing that's going to try to encourage companies to invest more in that kind of equipment. So, you know, initiatives like that, new spending to try to encourage innovation. One of the things that we really do need, I was a little bit disappointed that I did not see it in the in the provincial budget yesterday, was more money for colleges and universities. We know that colleges and universities are in pretty poor financial shape, but that's where a lot of your research and innovation comes from. So we do need to spend more money in that era. And again, given that we spend so much less than some of our other developed country peers, that should be a sort of a no-brainer for government, that we should be putting more money into research and development.
All right. I'm Colin Mang with us, assistant professor of economics at McMaster University. Bank of Canada saying in an emergency, break the glass. When it comes to productivity in Canada, it is declining over the last 6 years. Colin, thank you for the time. Be well.
Yeah, you're welcome. Bye, Scott.
All right. An interesting piece in the National Post from Tasha Kiradin, journalist and writer with the Post and G-Zero Media. It's fascinating, and it's tough to do when you go to, it's tough to, when you go to other countries, not to compare where that country for to what you, to where you are, obviously. And it's tough to do because it's, a lot of times it's apples and oranges. But Tasha made a trip to Japan recently and compared both Canada and Japan, and came up with some very interesting observations. Let's bring her in and talk about that. Tasha Kiradin, journalist, writer with The Post, with us now. Tasha, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Yeah, very jet lagged, but well, thank you.
Well, if you doze off, I'll understand. It's not just the show, it's the jet lag. All right, so this is very hard to do when you go to other places, and this is neat, too, when you go to places where people say it's a certain way, and then you find, well, yeah, it is in a little way, but it's also like us in many ways. What did you discover? What stood out as you toured Japan?
So the biggest thing was safety. I'd been told this, that it's a very safe country to travel in, but it was striking because it was safe in a way that I don't really remember experiencing in Canada for many, many years. But I did when I was a kid. When you go anywhere in Japan, first of all, everything is in major cities in particular, it was striking, very clean, very, there's no garbage around, people, there's no disorder. There, you know, we saw, I think, one person acting out in all the subways that we were in, who was obviously in mental health, you know, had mental health issues, who was yelling, and the kind of thing you see all the time, unfortunately, in the Toronto subway. You'll see people, you know, passed out, or you'll see people making noise, or people begging, or like begging is a crime in Japan. You cannot. It's an offense, so people don't. But the sense of safety, you see little kids taking the subway at 6 years of age. There was a kid I thought was with a parent. I thought it was his father. And no, the kid got off the subway by himself, 6 years old. And I did that when I was 7 years old. Montreal, I remember that. But you don't see that anymore. You don't feel any sense of threat anywhere you are. And that was really striking and eye-opening, something I didn't fully expect to feel when I was there.
So why do you think that is? Obviously, a completely different culture. Is it about culture and the society, or is it the way they deal with this, which I guess is one and the same? Is it more about law enforcement, less about that?
Well, you know, it's this. The columns actually elicited a huge number of responses. I always get people write in, but I've had many people write in saying that they felt exactly the same way when they were in Japan, and also the reasons why. You mentioned law enforcement. That is a big one. There's a system in Japan called Koban, where they have community policing like we don't have here. Community policing to us is, you know, you might have a beat cop who regularly walks around the same area or patrols the same. Now, this is, they have literally a storefront. They have 6,000 of these, and they have 6,000 other little stations where police actually live. Like, they actually live in the station. It's their home. But the ones with the Koban, it's a storefront. You've got three, maybe four policemen there. They engage with the people in a very different way. It's not negative. It's positive. They help tourists. You can drop off if someone loses their wallet. It's actually happened on my tour group. We found a wallet. You bring it to the Koban and you leave it there. And people know, oh, I can go pick it up later. It's a very trustworthy thing. So the relationship with police is very different. It's very embedded in the community. It's everywhere. And you also have, on the flip side, as people were writing to me, very harsh penalties for things like, because, you know, drugs, there's zero tolerance. Yeah. Even minor offenses are prosecuted, and you will get a jail term. If you steal a car, there's no bail for you. You're not out like the next day. So there's consequences, and a lot of other reasons too. But culturally, yes, culture is a big part of why these things exist in Japan. But they're not things that can't be replicated in other places. If you really put your mind to it and say, what do we, as a society, what do we want? Do we want some, you know, do we want a safe place where our kids can go to school by themselves? Do we want these kinds of things? What could we look at doing here differently?
We hear often here that we don't have the social safety net. Explain what is theirs like? Compare the two.
Well, social safety there, you have a different approach to homelessness, for example. They have a housing first policy. They have literally in the country 3,000 homeless people, 3,000 homeless people in a country of 125 million people. It seems almost absurd, but the government counts people. They do that. They have statistics, and they prioritize their whole concept. They don't want people to be without housing. So you don't have to, there's no preconditions. It's you know, you do have to, when you get housing, you have to then go through programs to detox, or you have to get a job, or there's conditions that are set afterwards. But to get the actual, you know, to get into the system, you don't have to detox first, for example. They also, you know, Japan has a very much pride order, but there's also a very big culture of respect. I didn't really write about this as much in my column, but it's known that shame and respect are sort of the flip sides of how Japanese society functions. So there's a certain shame in falling below a level, you know, yeah, socially, right? So people don't want to be, they wouldn't beg, they wouldn't act out. There'd be a shame factor there that we may not have here, because we've removed all the stigmas for everything we do. And there's, you know, there's good and bad to that. The good part is that you don't have people who are in this sort of dire, desperate situations that we see all the time in our major cities in Canada.
Would we stand for loss of freedoms to get there?
Well, that's a big one, right? Is that, you know, there are things like their gun laws that are extremely restrictive, that, you know, people here, I joke, conservatives wouldn't like this. You have to, you know, there's 12 steps to get a gun in Japan. Very few people have them. The result is that their gun crime legislation is, the gun crimes are, I mean, they had nine, for nine firearms offenses last year, 9. Okay. In Canada, we have thousands. It's the difference is incredible. But yes, you do accept a less freedom in certain ways. But on the other flip side, the freedom you get is, like I said, your kid's free to go to school without fear. And you're free to go around at 10:30 in the subway at night as a single woman, or, you know, with my teenage daughter, we were traveling, never afraid that something bad was going to happen to us. So that freedom actually was pretty nice. So I think we need to think about that balance and how we achieve it.
Good point. The latest from Tasha Kiradin in the Post, High Trust Japan shows just how low public safety standards are in Canada. Get some sleep. Thanks for the time, Tasha. Be well.
Thank you.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
All right, as you may or may not know, Ontario's budget was released yesterday, and it's always a giant document. Takes a while for the dust to settle and for everyone to wade through it. Let's get an update the day after. Colin DeMello with us, Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Global News. He's here now. Colin, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So the dust is settled. It's 24 hours later or almost. What stands out for you, Colin, in this budget?
Well, first and foremost, the strangest reality is taking root at Queen's Park, where the NDP, a party that's normally known for, you know, being spenders, are criticizing the Ford government and Conservatives, who are typically known as being spendthrift. The NDP is criticizing the Conservatives for spending too much. It's a really weird topsy-turvy time at Queen's Park, but it kind of goes to show you that the Ford government's budget seems to be, to a lot of people, a bit out of whack, because about a year ago, they had predicted that they'd be able to balance the budget and post $200 million surplus. Now they're running a $9.8 billion deficit, and the government is really standing proudly behind that. I mean, today we asked the finance minister about that, and he said, you know, these are tough economic times, and now was not the right time for budget restraint. But I asked him very specifically. I said, you know, this is a question about trust, right? The government claimed last year that they'd be able to balance the budget in 2024, and now they're kicking the can down the road to 2026. So why should voters trust the government when it comes to 2026 and that timeline and whether or not they'll balance the budget then? What if they kick it down the road again? And the finance minister looked at me and he said, events. That's what's led to this budget, because they're expecting slower revenue to come into Queen's Park due to fewer taxes coming in. And they're also expecting, you know, maybe a tighter economy, and that's why they had to spend so much. But all in all, the government is really defending its 2024 budget.
We are hearing that, whether it's federally or provincially, that there is some rough waters in the next year or so. The NDP say that they're spending too much. Is it in certain areas that should be spent in other ways? How do they justify that?
Yeah, I think the NDP's big question here is, you know, about the things that people might need, right? They're asking about affordability measures. Now, the government obviously announced that gas tax cut in 2022 that they're extending until the end of 2024. But the NDP is also saying, well, what about any other solutions to help people through the tax system, right? The Ontario Liberals, as an example, proposed some kind of a cut to the HST when it comes to home heating. The government is, of course, carrying forward the subsidy with electricity costs, but there aren't a lot of other affordability measures there. The one thing the government is doing that was really a big surprise to a lot of us was the amount of money they're pouring into healthcare, whether it's home care, primary care, or nurse retention. The government is spending some $3 billion over the next 3 years on this, right? They're spending $500 million to help connect some 600,000 people to primary health care in their own community, whether that's a mix of, you know, family doctor, nurse practitioner, etc. Then they're spending another $700 million over 3 years on nursing and healthcare retention, recruitment, additional spaces in colleges for healthcare workers, and really making sure that those who are in the system can get upskilled so that they can start doing more. And then there's $2 billion for home care, right, to make sure that people who are elderly and want to be cared for at home can do so for a longer period of time. That money will help hire new PSWs, for example. So the government is spending on the things that you would think or hope that they would be spending money on. Still, though, for the NDP, because they're in the role of official opposition, their role is to criticize, and that's kind of what they're doing.
As you said, it's not often that the left says the right is spending too much, and it isn't like the conservatives to do that. They're a little, as you said, spendthrift when it comes to certain projects and such. Do you get the feeling, Colin, that Ontario politics is starting to move really close to the center? I mean, it appears Doug Ford's taking it in that direction. Then, obviously, Bonnie Crombie, the new leader of the Liberal Party, she seems to be more a centrist. Do you think we're getting more to the center away from the extremes in provincial politics?
Yeah, listen, I mean, the 2018 election was very dogmatic because the progressive conservatives could be, and they knew that they would still sail to victory. 2022 was really the big difference, right? Where the Ford government realized it had to start building a coalition in order to maintain the same amount of voter support that they had in 2018. It wasn't going to be automatic. So they started tapping unions as an example to try to really broaden the PC party tent. And now, instead of going after Liberal voters, they seem to be saying, okay, well, you know, if people don't mind deficits, like they didn't mind them during COVID, Ontario ran a $40 billion deficit, well, they're not going to mind them now. And really, you know, nobody around the province is going around saying, oh my gosh, the deficit is at $9.8 billion. It doesn't really make an impact to a lot of people. So obviously, you know, the government is kind of moving itself a little bit more to the center, making itself a little bit more progressive rather than progressive conservative. And, you know, that could potentially net them some new votes in the next election. The question is, what about their base? There are a lot of fiscal conservatives within the PC party who don't like a lot of this spending. And if you compare what they're saying today versus what they were saying in 2018, the government wouldn't recognize itself. Back then, the government was saying, look, this is not our money. We have to treat it with care and respect. And all of this debt and deficit, this is what they said in 2018, it makes it harder for them to focus on their priorities. And it all goes in the credit card for future generations. That's exactly what the PC party was saying in 2018 after they got elected into government. So, you know, there is going to be a little bit of push and pull for them, especially within their own party.
What do you think we're going to see a budget? We've obviously got a budget right now in early 2024. What do you think we're going to see between now and provincial election time? I know that's still a long way away, but if you're spending a lot now, what do you do as you get towards an election?
Well, I think what I would say to a lot of people is you have to put these next 2 years in the context of the Greenbelt scandal. Right, the Greenbelt scandal was a very existential scandal for the government, and it hasn't quite gone away because the RCMP is still investigating. So the government now seems to be a bit afraid of its own shadow. They don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to do anything controversial. And if there's anything that could really end in a lot of backlash, the premier doesn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. And so from now until the next election, it seems to be in a little bit of protection and rehabilitation mode, making sure that they, you know, resuscitate their image from after the Greenbelt scandal, don't get into any more trouble. But that also means they don't do a lot of things. You know, since the Greenbelt scandal, we haven't seen them propose any grand vision, any big policy proposals. And even the ones like fourplexes, the government is unwilling to touch, even though they're getting official recommendations, because they're afraid of the scandal. So I think that's going to govern how they behave over the next 2 years. And we might really not see a lot out of them. We might see more liberal policies coming out of this progressive conservative government because they just need to protect what they already have.
Colin DeMello with us, Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Global News. Make sure you're watching Global Tonight for more on all of this. As always, Colin, thanks for the time. Be well.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Going to bring in Marvin Ryder, professor at DeGroote School of Business, McMaster University. You want to talk about restaurants. They're getting hit pretty hard now. And it's interesting because we talked about this coming out of the pandemic and how, you know, the hospitality industry was suffering. We all wanted to get out and help them out. And then we started talking about tipflation. All of a sudden we saw tips go up to like 20 and 25%. And what's that? And now I think with a more frugal market, the hospitality industry is feeling it again. Want to talk about that and the bridge collapse in Baltimore and how that will affect supply chain issues in various places. Marvin Ryder, professor at the Group School of Business, McMaster University. Marvin, I know we're all over the place here. Let's start with the ship. And okay. we all saw the footage of that bridge coming down. My goodness. And obviously six people that have perished in that accident. Luckily, it wasn't greater. But what does this do for supply chain at a time when supply chain has been a hot topic?
Well, the short answer is we don't know just yet. The Army Corps of Engineers have deployed 1,000 people to the site. Their first job is to reopen that shipping lane. Now, in fact, underneath that bridge, there were two lanes of shipping, one entering, one exiting. They just want to get one of them open at the moment. That boat is trapped right there at the moment with the steel infrastructure spread over the top of it. The Army Corps of Engineers is reluctant to give us a timeline on how fast it can reopen. They are suggesting, again, there are tons and tons and tons of steel that have to be removed. They also have to be brought up now from the floor of the water up whatever distance that happens to be, around five stories. So it's not going to be quick. And that's what we don't know. If they can get one lane reopened within a week or two, then I don't think the damage will be that big. But if it takes a month or two, well, it could be huge. Just to give you a sense, the Port of Baltimore is the number one port in the United States for the transportation of automobiles. More than 850,000 automobiles come into that port by ship or are exported out of the country by ship. And if that shut down for a couple of months, just imagine the repercussions going through. Now, no one's suggesting we're going to have a recession because of this, or it's going to fall apart. Clearly, everyone is scrambling to find alternate routes and alternate ways of delivering goods and services. But the longer at least one of those lanes is blocked, the worse the damage to the economy will be.
How do you think this will change shipping in the future? Fast forward. Obviously, we saw when, I believe it was in the Suez Canal, when a boat got stuck there. Does this change anything? Are we watching this?
Well, yes. Now, the biggest concern, of course, is that in the United States, there are more than something like 60,000 bridges across various rivers and lakes and other bodies of water. And is this a case of a bridge that was not properly maintained? Or more likely, this bridge has been open for 50 years. Was the design from 50 years ago not suitable for the way the world is today? Again, just to give you a sense of it, the boats that used to enter the Port of Baltimore 50 years ago carried one-tenth of the cargo of a typical boat today. If you've seen this boat that collapsed into the bridge, you know, it's deck after deck after deck of these storage containers, shipping containers that are coming in, tens of thousands of tons of cargo. So are all of the bridges in the United States, and I think this will trigger a dramatic review and likely, again, more infrastructure spending to bring it up to speed. In the meantime, we've got to get this one open, but then we're going to see a rollover from there. And I'm sure every state in the United States is once again reexamining the state of their bridges.
All right, let's talk about restaurants. We know the roller coaster ride that they've had in a post-pandemic world. We talked about how prices went up. It seems like there's backlash. We're starting to feel the reality here.
Yeah, in a way, this is a funny story, Scott, because I could tell you this has been the case for the last couple of years. So if you go back to 2022, literally 2 years ago, we suddenly saw inflation start to shoot up. It took nearly 6 months for it to hit a peak. But the minute the inflation started to shoot up, consumers said, ooh, we've got to be more careful about our spending. So we did see the restaurant industry under some stress at that time. The good news is finally inflation seems to be breaking. It's coming down to more reasonable levels, but we normally find that consumer confidence lags these economic indicators by a good 6 months. Now, I think when we get through to the summer and the fall, I imagine some of this pressure will go away because I believe that, I don't want to say the inflation, the worst of inflation is over, but it's all moving in the right direction, but it'll take 6 months. In the meantime, yeah, we're all watching our spending, and if we don't have to eat out, or if we do eat out, well, no appetizers, no desserts for us, maybe no wine with the meal. We've actually seen people cutting back on their liquor consumption that way. And one other quick note about all of this too, is that restaurants have never been the kind of investment you'd want to make for the long term. Before the pandemic, I would have told you that one in three restaurants close 3 to 5 years after it opens. It's just a very mature industry. Somebody can open something new and we go to it because it is a new place, but you can't be new forever. What's your sustainable competitive advantage out there? And the chances are most of them don't have it. So banks, for instance, have told you for a long time, they don't like investing in this sector for that reason. Add on now the frugality of the consumers. Yeah, I think we're going to see some restaurants close for sure. But here's the funny thing, Scott. Entrepreneurs are born every day. One closes, somebody else says, I can make a go of it, and they'll jump right back in.
Does it matter the type of eatery? Are we talking about dine-in only? Are the others doing well? Or is everybody feeling it, all categories?
Yeah, the one sector that doesn't seem to be affected is what we would call quick-serve restaurants. I don't want to call them fast food. That's not the politically correct term. But they still seem to be working. You know, you're time pressured, you're running short. Okay, I'm just going to stop by and grab something on the go. The fine dining restaurants, those where you and your wife might go out for a lovely meal, take your time, take a little respite from what you're having. The fine dining restaurants are feeling it. And as you can imagine, it's because the cost of eating there is more expensive. People are saying, well, maybe this is not the year we're going to have that nice anniversary dinner. I hate to say you're substituting Wendy's or McDonald's for it, but people are downscaling from those very fat, high, expensive meals they used to eat.
Marvin Ryder, professor at the Group School of Business, McMaster University, talking about everything supply chain, including feeding yourself. Marvin, as always, thank you for the time. Be well.
I will. Thank you.
All right. First of all, I got nothing against gambling, although I am incredibly cheap, so I don't do it. I often dream about what it would be like to win a big prize, but if you don't buy a ticket, that doesn't really help, does it? And you know, if I go to a Super Bowl party, I'll put my bucks down on a square and all that fun stuff, what have you. And so I'm not a prude, but on the other hand, when I watch a sports event or a sports cast of some game of some sort, it's flooded with gambling stuff. You know, you want to buy a commercial like KFC or Coke or Molson, just buy an ad. But to have it embedded so much into the actual event, I don't think it's productive. And, you know, I don't know anything about gambling. I don't even get into it. But I know what it is as a sports fan. For me, it's spoiling. It's spoiling the coverage of the game because I'm not into it. That being said, I understand some people are. Where do you draw the line? In a document entitled Gambling Policy Framework, the Toronto-based Center for Addiction and Mental Health also calls on the Ontario government to limit overall gambling availability, introduce mandatory safeguards, enhance prevention, education efforts, as well as everything that we have seen. Let's bring in Nigel Turner, Independent Scientist, Institute for Mental Health Policy Research, and here now. Nigel, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm well.
Nigel, I can see this is an industry, but to me it's like tobacco and alcohol. It seems like it's the Wild West right now.
Yes. I mean, it's much advertising in this field is in gambling is much more open than tobacco. Tobacco is quite limited in terms of what they can advertise, and so is alcohol. But gambling, pretty much anything goes, although the government has taken a step in the right direction of limiting the celebrities who may appeal to mm-hmm. youth. So we're happy with that, but I think there is additional safeguards they could take.
It seems, Nigel, as long as you run an ad about responsible gambling, or that you talk about the issues that can happen, you're fine. As long as you provide that phone number, if you have problems, just call these people. Is that enough? I mean, as I said, to me, this has completely changed how we watch sports.
Yeah, and I think it's also changed the meaning of an outcome in sports. If you're betting on a team and the line is +6, then the win and loss is changed. The dynamics of winning on you could win on the bet and yet your team still loses. That changes the way the game works.
The fact that we were in an economy, a world that we are, where affordability is an issue, how is that reflected in all of this?
Well, it's gambling is essentially a tax substitute. It's a way of in Canada, it's a way the government makes additional money that rather than raising taxes. But it's a tax that's directed. It's what they call regressive tax, because it's not directed at the people who can most afford to pay more. It's directed at people who are vulnerable to overspending on gambling.
So what needs to be done to balance this out? Is it a case of coming up with more of this is what can happen to you, or just cutting it back?
I would like to see the ads themselves cut back. I think focus on the consequences would be helpful as counterbalance. There was one ad which I thought was a decent ad where they say, but you can lose. But they didn't really emphasize the can lose. The can lose is not just a possibility, it's the norm. I mean, the casinos yes. wouldn't exist if they weren't bringing in your money, right? The norm is you lose.
So how do we process this? What does government do? What do fans do?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would like to see less of these ads. I'd like to see no ads during the game, because this is a game that people of all ages enjoy. Do we really want to tell our kids that gambling is the thing to do? And with kids, they're vulnerable to addictions more than adults, because their brain is still in that process of learning, acquiring new habits. So they are particularly susceptible to developing the idea that gambling is a good thing to do and to chase those losses. They don't really have the reasoning capacity to decide, okay, this is a way to lose money. A lot of kids are actually quite smart about gambling, and they don't gamble, but there is a greater vulnerability in the youth population.
I don't have a problem with the ads, Nigel. I have a problem with it just engulfing the whole show. It's just yes. placed throughout the show. I mean, you know, it's not like you see Ron McLean all of a sudden opening up a Coke and a bucket of chicken and start eating at the desk, yet we're talking about odds at the desk.
Yes, and there's so much of it.
Exactly. So is there a way to do that? You know, you want to buy an ad like Coke and Pepsi, you go right ahead, but, you know, it's not part of the game.
Right, right. And it's changing, you know, what is the game about? What is the purpose of sports? Is the purpose of sports to create a big casino, or is the purpose of sports to entertain and to extol the virtues of athleticism? And I think we're getting away from promoting athleticism and promoting, the idea of watching a healthy game, and we're focusing too much on the gambling.
Good point. Nigel Turner with us, independent scientist, Institute for Mental Health Policy Research, gaming, gambling, and the sports we watch. Nigel, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
Canada's inquiry into foreign interference. Remember that? We'll start again, beginning a couple of weeks of public hearings today after Ottawa joined its five allies in blaming China for widespread cyber attacks that U.S. officials have said have targeted politicians and Beijing's critics. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Is this moving forward, or is it death by delay? Let's bring in Stephen Chase, senior parliamentary reporter for the Globe and Mail, and here now. Stephen, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Yes, great to be here.
So your thoughts on where we are, it just seems I'm so concerned that this just keeps gets punted down the field. And the farther it goes, the less it resonates with Canadians. However, the one issue or the difference here, Stephen, is that there keeps coming up more examples of interference. Does that keep this story in the headlines? Are you concerned we're getting lost in the sauce here?
No, I think, China keeps providing us examples of in other countries of foreign interference, like the APT-31 hacking group that has been hacking dissidents and politicians and government departments and in the United States and the UK, and of course Canada just admitted last night, they too have been a target of this. So no, it gives an energy. So today was the first, I'd say, real day of hearings. We heard from a group of Canadians from the Russian community, from the Chinese community, from the Uyghur community, from the Sikhs as well. And they talked about their experiences. They were, it was really quite riveting. You know, just the people recounting what it's like when you're the target of a foreign government and how it affects every part of your life and you can't sleep and you're wondering what you're going to wake up to the next day. And people broke down on the stand and people told us stories about the kind of influence that repressive regimes are exercising our country. So it was a good first day.
Many have been concerned that, again, this is getting punted down the field, that it's being diluted in some ways, it's shortened. How is government reacting to the fact that this isn't going away, that this will continue to be an issue that concerns Canadians? Well, how are they reacting to this?
Eyeing this, you cannot accuse the Liberals of moving quickly on this. There's been a package of reforms, things that would address this, sitting on their desks for, I would say, 2 years now. At the top of which would be a foreign agent registry like Australia has, like the United States have, like the UK has brought in, and other reforms. They haven't done anything. They're watching this carefully, trying to figure out when the right time is to maybe look like they come up with a solution. But now the stories today are interesting. And it's, what's also interesting is you have these groups meeting for the first time. And one person the other day to say, the Iranian view, said, you know what? All our stories are so alike. The tactics are so similar. I'm really surprised about how much we have in common. So there's some really interesting discussions taking place. We're a nation of immigrants. My mom was an immigrant, and many people come from repressive countries. And I think there's a real awakening among these different groups of how they can start working together as well. So we're just at the beginning of 2 weeks of inquiry, and it's going to get faster and more furious, albeit interrupted by Easter, but then we'll continue next week and the week after.
Is this, many were concerned that this started with the investigating election interference into China, and now it's expanded and the time is limited. Are you worried that everything will get covered, or is it just this change in tone, or a change in tone, which will really be the big result here?
Well, I think that many people were concerned that all the evidence has been that it's China that's the problem. That's what you're hearing from CSIS. They are the foremost aggressor, and they are pervasive. It's everywhere at the municipal level. It's at in our military. It's all over the place. But what's interesting is you're getting different groups starting to realize they have a lot in common. So that's going to create a bigger political groundswell for action. You've now got the Sikh community, the Russian community, the Chinese community, all working to and realizing that this is a much bigger problem than any of them. So I think that's actually quite politically a potent mixture for the government. It's got to be very clear about how it moves forward, because it can't just off these groups.
We know when you and your colleagues broke these stories way back when, there was a lot of denial going on, and there was at one point the issue was the information wasn't getting from CSIS to the Prime Minister's desk. Has any of that process or procedure changed? Now we're concentrating on the actual issue, but again, you know, this was all slowed down because of denial and such. What about the information actually getting to the Prime Minister? Has anything been done there?
Well, I think that I'm not sure the information is getting to the Prime Minister. National security is not given a pride of place in decision making or in terms of access to the, you know, top decision maker. But what you have seen is far more. There's many organizations are now unwilling to be caught out again like they were last year when we revealed that they had been warned, that five different senior officials had been warned that a conservative MP was being targeted by China, and they did nothing. So I think that embarrassment served to make a change, which is now CSIS must directly warn any individuals who are seen to be targeted. So there's one change right there. But as I said before, there's a lot of other things that have to change, and they don't appear to have yet. I would not say this is a top of mind issue for the
Sorry, say that again. And not a top of mind issue for
the Liberal government.
It now appears that, again, as you said, with every story, with everything else that, whether it's China, Russia, whatever, do that, this provides more and more evidence that something is going on. We remember 2021 interference in that election that was supposed to favor, although both sides were attacked, it was supposed to favor the liberals in the last election. We are on the cusp or heading into another election. Are we confident? Are Canadians confident? Can they be that when they go and vote next time that there won't be interference, or that it will be monitored a lot more swiftly and efficiently than it has been?
I think at least for the next election, unless we make more changes, at least for the next election, there'll be far more awareness and far more people worried about being, you know, coerced into a situation or caught in a situation that stinks of foreign interference. So I think for the next election, for sure, it's going to be better. But the question is, do we put in changes to make it more long-term changes? And I also think one of the problems that keeps getting identified but nobody's doing anything about is some of the interference takes place during the nomination races, which are when you choose a candidate for each party to run in a riding. That process has gotten very little scrutiny, and I'm not even sure is going to get scrutiny in this as well. And that's still open, and the nomination races are taking place right now. So, and I think that's still something that's really not being watched carefully enough, and hopefully we are hearing about that today. We heard it several times from various actors, from various, tested witnesses. So I think that's still something that we need to pay careful attention to. But the next election will probably be the one where everyone's the most aware of this. The question is whether the Liberal government or a successor government put in changes that will make sure that we're better protected going beyond that.
What do you think is going to be the result of this inquiry? 2 weeks later, what do you think is going to happen? Does any of this stick? Do we move forward? Do we come up with a better way of doing things? Is it going to have an impact?
Recommendations, including a foreign agent registry. I think that we still got. I'd like to see a few of the people testify in the next 2 weeks and see before I can tell you with more certainty what I think is going to happen. But I do think there's going to be recommendations for changes. And I think it's some of the same things the Liberals have been sitting on for 2 years.
Stephen Chase with a senior parliamentary reporter with the Globe and Mail. The inquiry into foreign interference is continuing. And Stephen Chase is covering it for us, for everybody, for the Globe and Mail. Stephen, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
You're welcome. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.